Hello, everyone, or 你好吗? And welcome to our Chinatown Teen Council project. We're doing the oral history project produced to you by ConnectaPod. We're here interviewing John Yi today of the 54th District.
Yep, Assembly. I'm a candidate for the California State Assembly District 54.
And we're here today with me, myself, Ryan. And to my left, we have
Caleb Leong.
Malia Mahalona Janelkarn.
Michelle Choi.
And to reintroduce himself, Mr.
John Yi. Good to be here with y'all.
Thank you.
So coming at you with the first question, Mr. John Yi, tell us a little bit about yourself, like your backstory.
Yeah, well, I was born and raised not too far from where we are right now in Koreatown, Los Angeles. It's on the other side of downtown. My parents came to the U.S. in the 1970s. Their story is a lot like a lot of Korean-American immigrant stories. A lot of political tumult was going on at the time. And so they came here, made a small business, and pretty much was able to raise a family, buy a home, take care of my grandparents. My mom's first job was sort of selling flowers in gas station parking lots. My dad was actually a gas station attendant. Through the hard work, my parents eventually, my mom owned her own flower shop on Crenshaw. And then my dad became a minister. He went to seminary and became a pastor. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background and sort of, you know, why I'm here today. It's because of the hard work of my parents.
So what motivated you to run for California State Assembly?
Yeah, you know, the big reason why I ran is because I saw what was going on in my grandfather's life, like the last 5 years before he passed away. Something I really believe is the best way to understand the health of your community is to look through its eyes, to look through the eyes of its seniors. Because our seniors are the ones who depend on public resources, public assets, who depend on programs. And so when I saw what was happening with my grandfather, I really realized there's a big need to better serve our communities. And so, for example, it took us forever to find him senior housing in Koreatown. Rents were so high, he literally ping-ponged from one uncle's home to another aunt's home because we couldn't find him senior housing. Yeah, and then, you know, the second issue in K-Town, we don't have any good public spaces for seniors. I'm sure in Chinatown, you have similar issues. In Chinatown, there's no place to sit, if you notice. But there's no benches. There's no real grass or lush sidewalks here in Chinatown. Koreatown is similar. You know, where my grandfather would hang out every day would be the local McDonald's. Every day, except for Sunday, because he doesn't go to church. But every day, he would hang out with his friends at the McDonald's, buy the senior coffee, and sit there hours on end because there's no public space. And actually, during the pandemic, they would actually bring chairs and sit in the parking lot of the McDonald's. And that's where they would hang out. On one of these days, one of his friends was walking to the McDonald's to hang out, and he was hit by a car and killed, a senior. And that is happening to a lot of our seniors in Koreatown, and I would venture to say here in Chinatown as well. You know, car crashes are the leading cause of death of our elementary and middle school kids. If you look at all the death data of those who are killed by car crashes, a lot of them are seniors of color. And so, I mean, I saw viscerally our failure as a community to take care of our seniors. And surely, if there was any place where a Korean senior could be serviced, it would be Koreatown. I mean, it's in the name, but we had failed him even in Koreatown. And so that's why I decided to run. Because if not me, who's going to fight for my grandfather, then who? And so that's why I decided to run. And I would venture to say the story of my grandfather is not just a story of my grandfather. It's a story of so many seniors throughout the district. In Chinatown, Boyle Heights, you don't have to be even Korean or Asian for that matter. Latino communities go through similar issues with senior care, multi-generational families. And so, you know, when I realized my story is not just my story, but a story, a collective story of so many people in this district who are crying for more and need better representation, I decided to run.
I mean, not to like interrupt the flow, but what exactly is the California State Assembly?
Oh, fantastic question. Let me ask you, do any of you know who your assembly members are? Yeah. When running for office, oftentimes when people hear that I'm a candidate, they either think I'm running for Congress or for city council. No one knows anything about the State Assembly. And for me, this is by design. So let me tell you what the assembly members do. So the state of California is governed by, like any sort of level of governments, by an elected body, right? Congress, we elect people for Congress, we elect people to city council. The people that sort of run the state is your state assembly. They are people we elect here locally that we then send to Sacramento to make laws for us. And then they work with the governor, whom we all vote for a governor. They work with the governor on passing laws. As your state assembly member, you have two major responsibilities. First is passing laws. Laws could be about policies. A lot of it is about budgets, how to spend money. And the second responsibility of your state assembly member is to navigate government programs for your constituents. We have trillion-dollar agencies whether it's health related, education related, transportation related. And these agencies really impact community health and community well-being. And so your responsibility of your legislator is to navigate these systems for you. Going back to what I said earlier, you know, every year the state of California decides how to spend about $300 trillion. Just to give you that scope, that is how much money this nation of Austria decides how to spend every year. That is how much money that is on the table that we decide to spend. The state of California is the fourth largest economy in the world. Fourth largest economy. To be a state legislator for California is not the same as being a state legislator for Rhode Island, for New Jersey, for Maryland. I mean, not to diminish them, but we are the largest subnational state in the world because that's how big of an economy we are, populous of a state we are. So your state assembly members has immense influence, not just in California, but for the rest of the country. When we decide tailpipe emissions, so when we decide all cars that are sold in California must have, you know, cleaner tailpipe emissions, that impacts the rest of the nation. When we decide car emission standards, the rest of the nation follows us because, again, car companies want to make sure they fit our mold because we're one of the largest car markets. So that's another example of how much power we have as a state. But if we do not know what that power is, if we do not know who represents us, which is the current state of affairs, we as a community are leaving so much at our table. That is another reason why I'm running. I'm not running just because I am the best candidate. I am the best candidate, but I'm also running because this position needs to be held accountable. We need to know what this position is doing, especially if our communities are looking the way they are right now. Also, if I, you know, California, we're the largest employers. We just have, because our state is so big, we have so many agencies, we have so many public school teachers, we are the largest employer in the country. And as a result, we have the largest retirement fund. I don't know if you guys, do you guys have work or jobs, paid jobs? Okay. So once you start paying a job, what happens is you pay into like a retirement fund, usually if you're like in part of a company, and that money goes to a retirement fund. And eventually once you retire, you know, you get that money back and you live off of that money. Because the state of California is one of the largest employers in the nation, it has a gigantic retirement portfolio, fund portfolio, CalPERS, and they get to decide what to invest in. And that can shape markets because so much money is in this retirement fund. And so, for example, a few years back, they decided, you know, we are no longer going to invest in tobacco companies because that is antithesis to our beliefs. So they pulled out their money from tobacco companies. And so I think there's another space where your state legislators can really shape markets by deciding, you know, where to invest some of these funds and these monies.
What plans do you have for Chinatown District and the district in general?
Yeah. So something that we're saying on our campaign. Well, and so for the listeners, I think, you know, for the listeners who don't know, who weren't with us, we just finished a sort of a workshop, right, on the gondola and the importance of fighting back these kind of like millionaire thrusted projects in our communities. So something that we're saying in our campaign is like, especially when it comes to the housing crisis, is how do we give communities more ownership of the land they live on? That way, when we own the land we live on, we grow with its development. We benefit from it, actually, like a lot of homeowners do, instead of getting displaced. And so some of the things we're talking about on our campaign is how do we give communities more ownership of the land? So there are solutions like social housing, for example, where renters can eventually purchase their apartments. Community land trust. I know Chinatown recently opened up a Chinatown community land trust. This is when a nonprofit or renters come together to purchase a home that they own and they keep the rent low. Fixing our state's first-time home buyers program, right? So working-class families can, again, own the land they live on. So that's something that we're really interested in doing. And how do we build that to a larger scale where, you know, it's not just one project here, one project there, but we can start actually creating in the marketplace a new separate sort of sector for community-rooted housing solutions. Because right now, most of the housing is in a marketplace system where you buy and sell based off of profits. And that, again, that's how markets work. But I think we need to start creating a different path, an alternative path, where there's more community-rooted solutions that's not based off of a market commodity. And so some of the things I mentioned earlier, those are ways we can build that space. But the problem and the challenge is money. You need money to build buildings. They're expensive. So I think this is the space where government can play a leading role, whether it's passing bond measures, whether it's, you know, raising funds on the state level to give more funding for these kinds of projects. So those are some of the solutions we're hoping to do. That way, for example, if I own property here, if I own the land I live in, I can actually have more grounding to push back against the gondola versus if I was a renter and my building was owned by someone who would materially benefit from a gondola being built, I have no say in that whatsoever. But if I own my apartment, then I actually have a say in the development of the land. And that is how rich, wealthier communities on the West Side can preserve their neighborhoods because they own the land they live on. They have homeowners associations that lobby on their behalf, right? And so we need to build a similar kind of infrastructure in for our own communities, especially considering how many renters we have in our district.
So in the Chinatown Teen Council, a bunch of teens deliver groceries to seniors in boroughs which are single room occupancies. It's like about 40 or so teens. We partner up with APIFM, which deliver groceries to the library, and all of us pack the groceries into bags, and then we go on foot to deliver groceries to six SROs. And the seniors are very happy to see us, right? So us teens are very concerned about the seniors, and we would want to ask you, if are you going to make Chinatown more accessible to the seniors?
Thank you for this question, actually. We talk about three issues in our campaign, and senior care is one of three issues. And it's sort of selfish for me to make that an issue, because as a millennial, this is something that I have to actually deal with every day because my parents are seniors. They retired late last year, and they live in New Jersey. Actually, they're in Korea right now, but they're going to eventually come to the LA. And I have to ask myself, what do I need to do to prepare for that arrival? I got to make sure they have a home where there's no stairs, because it just takes one fall for a senior, and not only will their lives change, but everyone around their lives will change. So that's something that I encourage you, as your parents get old, make sure there's no stairs in the house. Other issue is, like, what is the money that I need to save to take care of my parents? You know, I said earlier about my own grandfather's experience, seeing how his senior experience was the last sort of 10 years of his life really opened my eyes about how broken some of our systems are when it comes to caring for our seniors. So, for example, in-home care, that is, as we all know, when you get older, you don't want to be in a hospital. You don't want to be in a hospital. You want to age at home. You want to age in place, around family, around things you're comfortable with, around people you know. And so the state has something called an in-home care program, where they actually pay people to take care of their parents or their grandparents or a relative in their home. And this is not only financially more effective, because people are healthier when they're staying at home for in-home care, but also saves the state money, because they don't have to use expensive or take up beds in hospitals. But this program is fundamentally broken. There is a wait list for people to get on. My own family tried to benefit from this program, but as monolingual Korean-speaking immigrants, they had no idea how to navigate the system. And so where do they turn to? Like most Koreans, they turn to the church. So they hired someone at church to be my grandfather's senior care provider. And this happens all the time. There are chat groups in church groups. There's chat groups in Korean-American-speaking Kakao Talk. It's like our version of, yeah, you guys know it. Where we they're looking for senior care. And this person that we hired ended up stealing money from my grandfather. And so this is a failure of a system that is not taking care of our seniors, especially if you are monolingual and you can't access these programs, if you have distrust of government, which a lot of our communities do. And so this is an area where we need to really fix it, because ahead of us is a graying generation of seniors. And especially for this district, we have monolingual seniors who do not have confidence or know-how of government. As a state legislator, your job isn't just to make laws, but to navigate government bureaucracy, navigate government programs. So if you want to get a business license, if you want in-home care, if you want retirement benefits, these things that you are entitled to as a California resident are far further out of reach if you don't speak English, if you're not juiced in with local government. Instead, you turn to the systems you know, which, again, in my case, was the church. So that's why it's going to be important to have someone who's elected, who's able to navigate those systems, to bring those resources to communities, especially immigrant communities, which is our district. And so in-home care is one, you know, aging in place. You know, with climate change, a lot of our seniors are in our districts live without air conditioning. There used to be a day we didn't really need air conditioning in Los Angeles because, you know, the days weren't getting as hot. But every year, because of climate change, we are getting more and more extreme heat days. And so a lot of these residents are stuck in these buildings without air conditioning. So even small stuff like making sure they have air conditioning, are there subsidies so that the seniors can, you know, cool their apartments, is going to be important. Infrastructure is another issue. Loneliness is a big issue with seniors. And I think there was a study about loneliness is like actually the number one killer for a lot of seniors. But if you have infrastructure where it is not safe to go out, if there's too many cars and so you don't feel safe walking, or someone you know got hit and killed, the lack of public parks or green areas to sit and rest, like we were talking about earlier. If you live in this part of Chinatown, you have to walk all the way to State Historic Park to find any kind of greenery. So making sure even our infrastructure is up to play when it comes for our seniors is going to be important. Again, these are all political questions. And so having public servants who understand this, put the money behind it, is going to be important.
Our teen council's former president, Jang Young, who is also a part of this project, his grandparents, both of them live in Cathay Manor, which is an SRO that is
right.
a couple Broadway. Streets yeah. away from this library. Yeah.
I mean, and it's notorious, I think, what happened there with, I think they're trying to push out the seniors. I mean, I think, was that the one that where the elevators weren't even working?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Back in 2021, we held a grocery distribution in partner with a couple of other organizations. And this was when there was only one working elevator. And even then, it had to be like manually operated. It was a really big problem because the operator only spoke English. And as you know, most of the seniors only spoke Chinese. And so there was a huge language barrier. And it was difficult to communicate anyway, because there's like, what, about 13 or so floors. And so it was just really difficult for the seniors to be able to like request the elevator. The only other option was to take the 13 flights of stairs, which were all indoors. It was very stuffy and crowded inside there. Like, we had to walk all of our bags of groceries while delivering to the different floors. And I can only imagine like how painful and difficult it must have been for the seniors.
I think there's like, because it's like senior housing or something, like the city, I guess, provides money to like maintain it. I'm not like 100% sure on like the amounts or like what the policy is like, but I know it's like something along the lines where it's like kind of like subsidized, I guess.
Yeah. So they're getting public funding, but yet they're driving the quality down.
Yeah.
Something else that can be, for more information about SROs, a lot of SROs are typically 10 by 10 rooms, very small living space. Sometimes people there have roommates because they physically can't afford it. And even then, it is very hot in there with no provided air conditioning. A lot of the times, the tiles and the hallways are coming apart. Mm-hmm. Lights are not working well. Sometimes the kitchen, they all share one kitchen with about almost 20 other people, and also like two bathrooms there with also around 20 other people. They have to provide their own things for this. So what do you think you can do to help like these people in these situations?
There's a lot of issues here that I think we can unpack, right? The lack of available senior housing. So the fact that there's no other option for these seniors, so they have to be stuck in places like this. The lack of transparency when it comes to ownership of these properties and the management of them. There have been instances where I know rent, like landlords have refused to cash even checks so they can evict residents. So, well, this is what I will say about the situation, that this is a issue of power, that renters do not have anywhere near power homeowners have. And so something that we need to think on this level is, how do we give more power to renters? And I think one way is to, as I said earlier, is ownership of the land. If your name is on the deed and you are the owner, you have power. Another way we do it is transparency about ownership of these properties. I said earlier, it just takes one developer to make one decision, then that will impact dozens of working class families. And so, you know, there has been efforts in this in Sacramento, which have failed. But why don't we have a registry of all the properties? And then when there is a sales happening, we make that information public. Because too often these sales happen under the cover of night, kind of like the gondola, and we only find out when it's sort of all the way baked through. So are there ways we can, as a state, we can build in more transparency about sales? We can build in more transparency about who gets to buy, who gets to sell. There's even talk about, if you're going to sell a building, by law, you should make it legally required that first you offer sales of that building to the residents. Let them say, no, I don't want it. Then you go out to the free market and find someone, right? So are there ways, again, but this is, again, leveling the playing field between renters versus landlords, renters versus property owners. And it's not just that. Also, we have to also look at the area that the fact that a lot of people who are buying properties, they're not your mom and pop landlords. Have you heard of these like private equity firms like Blackstone? This is something that y'all should be worried about of your own future, because one day you might be at buying a house from Warner Brothers, or you might, I'm serious. In Korea, do you know who builds homes? Hyundai, Samsung. They have apartment buildings named, called Samsung apartment buildings, Kia apartment buildings. Conglomerates, they make in Korea, make everything from rice cookers to apartment buildings to cars. One day we might get to the point where you have apartment buildings that are run by Walmart. And this is the scary future, but this is what housing as a market commodity will lead to. If you have a marketplace, the people who usually bubble to the top are those with capital and money. And that is what's happening to housing right now. You have these private equity firms. Initially, I thought they were just buying multi-unit homes, like apartment buildings. But they are now buying single-family homes, tracks upon tracks of it. Culver City, they're buying them. And so how is this equitable? If, you know, if we're going to start treating our homes like we treat our phones, where it's just based off of marketing and a product by a private company. So I think we need to really rethink who is able to buy property. Maybe, not maybe, rethink how many properties should one person even own. Again, every time you hear an elected person, a politician or someone who runs for office talk about housing, they will say housing is a right. I'm sure you can find plenty of videos like that. But housing cannot be a right in a marketplace system where housing is a market commodity. So again, I think it is a responsibility of government to be able to be a fair referee in this space and to level the playing field for renters because, yeah, right now it is just completely unfair.
So you mentioned, right, that it's like a very commonly shared concept, I guess, that housing should be a right for everyone and they have a right to own their housing. As an assembly member, what kind of power would you have to change that?
So there is like the marketplace where housing is bought and sold, right? And as an assembly member, I think you have multiple ways you can tackle a market system that is failing. You can either A, add incentives into the market system to nudge people to move in a certain direction. So the way we see this is cutting down red tape for affordable housing developers, making it easier to build affordable housing by, you know, making this process more streamlined. So that's one way you take the market and you kind of give it incentives to push it into developing more market housing. So that's one way you can do it as a legislator. My argument is that, sure, that's cute, but that's not enough. And that's why we see this all the time. We get news reports saying such and such built, like 100 unit building was built and six of it is for affordable housing. Like we've read articles about this in a region where we need 500,000 affordable housing units. So that is one approach. As a legislator, I will support that approach. But for me, it's cute stuff, but it's playing around the edges. I will go back to what I said earlier is we as a state legislature, as a government need to carve a new space in the marketplace where housing is not a commodity. Instead, where housing is rooted in community need and the government needs to help raise funds for those kind of projects. So that is how I see us doing that. So that is how I see us working the marketplace. That's the first thing. The second way I think your state assembly member can really fix this problem is give more rights to renters. So things like, you know, every apartment building has a homeowners association or every like those unit, those big the single family home development areas, they create political organizations. They won't call them political, but they are, where they pay their dues and these groups advocate for their beliefs. You know, we need something similar for renters. So are they renter councils? So do we mandate that, you know, buildings with renters have renters councils, give them some degree of power? So how do we, level the playing field when it comes to power for renters? That's another way to do it. On a more short-term scale, I think renting subsidies might be needed for renters, especially those on the brink of homelessness. How do we prevent people falling into homelessness to begin with? Because once you're homeless, it's really tough to get out of it. It could be a subsidies for rent. It could be even loan forgiveness for nurses or teachers who are on the brink of homelessness. It just doesn't have to be about housing, but how do we reduce the cost of people's life, right? So that they have more money in their pockets. I think that is the bottom line. So rent subsidy is one. Free public transit, right? So people don't have to have the burden of transportation are the ways to do it. So those are some of the things as a state legislator you can explore to fix this crisis.
In Chinatown, like I've seen a lot of seniors like with very bad health conditions. Like in the library, I've helped a senior that she had like arthritis and couldn't move and she was in a lot of pain. And also another senior trying to cross the street, but it was already the red light and I had to help her across the street. And she was telling me she was old and she couldn't walk as fast as other elders, and like a lot of other seniors in Chinatown that are struggling with their health, but there aren't any nearby hospitals. Adding to what you said about how people are getting hit by cars, if something like that were to happen, it would be really hard to bring a senior to a hospital, mm-hmm. which is like 15 minutes away from Chinatown. So if you were a council member, what would you do to help the seniors with their healthcare?
Yeah. No, thank you for bringing this up. I mean, I've been told well known how Chinatown lacks grocery stores, hospitals care for their seniors. I think you're hitting on an issue, which is what makes a healthy community, right? And we would say parks, hospitals, you know, dignified sidewalks, access to grocery stores, fresh produce. Like that is what makes a community. But I think oftentimes when we think about how others look about building communities, it's usually based on businesses, the availability of restaurants or cafes. So maybe there is something worth even exploring on the state level, that when we're building communities based, especially certain kind of communities that are, you know, designated in an area, it is required that we build some kind of social good, whether it's hospitals. Maybe based on populations, we can create a state law where they're saying if you have a certain number of populations, you have to have a certain number of hospitals that's tied to that population level. I think we have to be more creative about how we design our communities, because oftentimes it goes back to the marketplace. It is the marketplace that designs neighborhoods, right? It is the marketplace that's selling a property that decides what goes where, whether it's a coffee shop, whether it's a health clinic, right? But again, it is the role of government in spaces where they are failing to provide a public good, where government needs to come in and say, hold on, the marketplace isn't really working here. We're willing to build a gondola and a bunch of new cafe and restaurants here, but we're not building a hospital or any kind of clinic for the community. So it is in that kind of space where the market isn't working, the government can come in, create laws, create accountability so that we have these resources available for our seniors.
You mentioned a while ago how many seniors in Chinatown and, you know, in other places as well, especially immigrant seniors who are monolingual, their first language may not be English, and they don't really trust the government or like know how all of these policies work. So I know that you're very big on fighting against gentrification, advocating for housing equity and infrastructure. But I was curious if you have any ideas or plans about being able to educate these kinds of residents on how these policies work so that hopefully they can get involved and advocate for themselves as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting, I think, at the core of a functioning democracy, right? That the people should know what's going on and be educated about it. And I think today's workshops, like the gondola that's thrown by Edwin, Phyllis, and Tanny, is a great exercise of that core principle. I think in the capacity of me running for state assembly, that is also the job of your state assembly member, to be able to inform the community about the projects she or he is working on and get not only buy-in and support, but their active participation in designing whatever that project is, be a law or project in the community. So, you know, I think it's going to be important, but, you know, I would make the argument that there has been a resignation of responsibility on, especially from our state level electeds, on local everyday issues. And given the housing crisis, the homeless crisis, I think a lot of our state elected officials are more than happy to relinquish responsibility to city council or to Congress, because I think both of those things are more visible to elected voters. So this goes back to the question I said earlier about when you asked me about, you know, what does the seat even do? People really don't know. And I think as a result, you get the conditions we see here today, because we, again, are leaving so much money on the table by not holding this seat accountable. And so, again, that is another reason why I'm running, is because I want to be able to co-govern with my community, educate my community, and have my community educate me, not only as a candidate, but also as a legislator. And I think that kind of constant dialogue has to be ongoing. And my background is in community organizing, so I'm naturally, that is something that I'm used to. When I'm running, the thing I always think about is, what kind of legislator would I want as a nonprofit? Because I'm the executive director of a nonprofit. So I try to be the kind of legislator that I would want a legislator to be as a nonprofit ED. And that is someone who is open, engaging, and willing to be there from the beginning of an idea, not just after it's all baked and done and the community support to pass it. So I think your question you're hitting on is, how do we make sure that entire process, the community stays involved? And I think a lot of it is the great work of community organizers like Edwin, Tanny, and Phyllis, but also is the responsibility of government, of our public servants that we elect. So that's, thank you for keeping us, you know, accountable to that.
Out of curiosity, like, how did you like learn about all of this? How the different government structures work, like how the assembly works? And
it was when Obama became president. I just had graduated college, and I just came out of the closet. And so for me, as a guy who was openly gay, it was a very easy choice. Do I go for the Democrats or the Republicans? Republicans are still awful on LGBTQ issues now. So I chose Democrats. And so ever since then, I had a party behind me that I associated with. I had at least one issue that I was passionate about, you know, LGBTQ rights. And I think that was my entry into politics. And you all have similar stories. You don't have to be queer. It could be another issue. It could be, you know, a student, you're a woman, you're, you know, you're an immigrant. I mean, whatever it is that inclines you to look at politics and say, I need that to change because it is not serving me now. I think that is what got me into politics when I realized that through federal elections. And so once you start pulling at that thread, you start pulling at housing, you start pulling at other rights, international affairs, budget issues. And I just did that throughout between then and now. I'm always pulling at these threads. And when you pull at threads, you realize there are systems responsible for creating these laws that impact my life. And the state legislature is one of them. And so that's why I'm running for it.
So that was our interview with Assembly Member Candidate John Yi. And if you'd like to find more information about him, you can find him at
www.johnforassembly.com. That's johnforassembly.com.
And do you have any like social medias?
Yes. So you can follow us on, I'm pretty active on Instagram. So you can follow us at johnyi_LA.
Thank you. Well, that was our interview with John Yi. And so thank you everyone for listening in to the Chinatown Oral History of Gentrification Project. Once again, brought to you by the Chinatown Teen Council and Connectified. Signing off, this is Malia Mahalona Janokarn.
This is Ryan.
Caleb Leong.
And this is Michelle Choi. I would like to say and Duo Bao Zhong to all of our Chinatown seniors and residents.
Zaijian.